30th in Leningrad, where Mr. Oistrakh was the soloist with the Leningrad Philharmonic Orchestra under Eugene Mravinsky. It's quite natural that Mr. Oistrakh should have been the only one to perform the concerto thus far, since, as we've said, it's to him that the work is dedicated. Like the Mozart A major on the first half of today's program, the Shostakovich Violin Concerto has several unusual features. First of all, it's in four instead of the customary three movements, the last two of them joined by a cadenza. Secondly, these movements have titles. The first is a nocturne, the second a scherzo, the third a passacaglia, and the fourth a burlesca. Finally, the orchestral scoring for Shostakovich is exceptionally light and transparent. There are no trumpets, no trombones at all, though there is a tuba to give a bass foundation to the four horns in the brass section. And the solo violin, you notice, plays almost continuously throughout the entire concerto. There's hardly a break at all. This, by the way, marks the seventh Philharmonic premiere of a work by Shostakovich. The orchestra gave the first New York performances of the piano concerto and the suite from the ballet The Golden Age, the first New York concert presentation of the seventh Leningrad Symphony, the Western Hemisphere premieres of the eighth, and then last season, the initial performance in this country of the 10th Symphony. David Oistrakh has returned to the stage, followed by Mr. Metropolis, and now with the New York Philharmonic, they perform for the first time on the air in America the Violin Concerto in A Minor by Dmitri Shostakovich. Thank you. Further degree, but with a demonic quality that they could never achieve, and which gave a validity to that viewpoint which they themselves could never have.
Well, actually, I found in the Germanic performances that I have heard by authentic Germans, let's say in Munich and so on, that there wasn't a very strict adherence to beat. That's what I meant before by saying self-indulgence, that the lyrical second theme of a sonata allegro movement will invariably be meno mosso, will be slower. That the minute it gets lyrical, it gets slow, and tends, therefore, to get sentimental. This is something Toscanini would never allow. But your point is very well taken about the demonic quality, because what I think above all things Toscanini taught everybody about playing, particularly Beethoven, was that the sense of drive that has to be there is the main thing. It's more important than any single detail. So that if you dawdle over a detail in Beethoven's Seventh, you can probably get a great deal of musical pleasure or satisfaction out of that one spot, but you may be injuring the totality of the piece.
You know, this influence, of course, has extended very deeply to the instrumentalist as well. We're all conscious, and I think rightly so, much more so today, of the inevitability, the necessity of having an inevitable line from beginning to end within which we can permit ourselves our variances according, and especially according to what the composer wrote. If he wrote a variance, we follow it. But we try to establish a line from the beginning to the end of a work. You know, it's interesting sometimes in talking about this to see the different approaches of great musicians. For instance, Casals. Listening to Casals at times in a part of a composition will perhaps give you an impression of great freedom, terribly rubato movement.
Almost improvising.
Almost. And yet, if you have listened to him very carefully or hear the composition from beginning to end, he has a peculiarly unique quality to him of being able to extend the margins of his line within which he allows himself his liberties, but the margins march along as inexorably as any line you would want to
as
define.
As if it were all in strict meter.
Except that he can conceive his line on such broad terms and still hold it, which is...
In other words, one liberty makes sense with the other.
Exactly.
In context.
Exactly.
Whereas by itself it might seem overdone. I must say that that's probably the mark of any great musician. And in a sense, musicians must always have been conscious of that. It's only a matter of degree. And what Toscanini did was codify it, more or less, because his recordings and performances were models of just how far you could go given any particular frame.
Well, don't you feel, Lenny, that the last, let's say 15, 20 years, has seen a rebirth of what is actually an old idea in music, the old classic form with full romantic impact and with fervor and with the kind of drive that we've been speaking of, those things which we feel are important in music, but where we're beginning away a little bit from the
great romantic freedom that had existed, say, between 1870 and 1925.
Exactly.
Yes. And that we've been coming more and more back to what are the basic truths, what we think are the basic truths in music, within which we permit ourselves our freedoms, but beyond which we will not go in as far as what we consider good taste.
I think that's what every musician of our generation is struggling for. I know certainly it's what you're struggling for, hearing various performances of yours. I don't know if it would surprise you to be told that you're considered a great romantic on the violin, and much more romantic than, I won't mention any names.
Let's not.
But given all that, judging from a performance of the Beethoven Concerto I heard you do a year or so ago, of course it's romantic in the sense that all performances of great music must be romantic to a certain degree, but there is a purity and a drive and a forward motion in that performance, as I remember it, which is one of the great memories I have of any musical performance. And this is, it seems offhand to be a struggle. There seems to be some sort of clash of two purposes, and yet it's the very clash which makes the synthesis we're driving for, I think.
That's right.
Which is the combination of freedom and stricture. And I think you're one of the best examples of that I know.
Well, I find that to be very evident, the kind of conducting you do, the kind
well,
of...
Well, now it's becoming mutual admiration.
Well, I don't mean that.
We
happen to be friends of long standing, and we see eye to eye, fortunately, musically, when we work together this... as we've also often seen, that we don't have to chew ideas over very much. We sort of instinctively come to them. But I've seen the same thing happening to colleagues of mine, the younger group of instrumentalists coming along now in piano, violin, who respect this idea of using the instrument to make a musical line rather than being virtuosi first and foremost.
Or concentrating excessively on details.
That's right. And I think it's a sign of the health of our musical standards today.
But of course the ultimate aim would be to get all those details in too, in addition to the
That is the final test of
but
artistry.
But never at the expense of the big line.
Well, that's the definition of artistry. It's a rather long-winded one, but as a matter of fact, it is. It's that quality of being able to keep to a line, to keep to an idea that has been given to you, a sort of blueprint, and infusing it with that personal excitement, that wondrous achievement in your own mind, in your own heart, in your belly, as it were, and making it live to an audience in your own personal terms, and still not having it deteriorate into your work, but the composer's work.
I would rather doubt that I've ever achieved that in any single performance to this date.
I don't know if anybody ever really achieved it. I don't think it's achieved in a performance, Lenny. I think it's achieved as an approach towards the way you live with music over a long period of time. I don't think it's a performance quality. It's an attitude.
Well, the most one can do is keep going for that stuff.